Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of Mind Shift Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, coming to you once again from a beautiful day here on the Rock here in North Wales. I've just returned from 2 weeks spent in Seattle in the United States. Funny enough, it's the first time I have been there in 10 years. I could not believe how much things have changed since I was there the last time. For one thing, it's gotten way more expensive. They say that Seattle is 49% higher than the national average in terms of cost of living, and I can well believe it. It's unbelievably expensive, but it was nice to see friends and family, and in fact, I caught up with some buddies of mine that I hadn't seen in over 20-some years. We went to high school together, and you know, one of the things that we reflected on, all of us in different ways, we all grew up in the church, we all grew up in Christian schools. And we all reflected on the fact, in fact, I tweeted on about this the other day with the hashtag #HowToEvangelical, which is trending right now, about how even though we all grew up in the church, we've all had to go through some sort of counseling, some sort of therapy to basically recover from the effects of fundamentalism, the effects of Christianity on our lives, psychologically, emotionally, in some cases, in terms of sexuality. Unbelievable, the effect that church and Christianity can have on so many people. And in fact, this is the topic that Karen Garst and I are going to get into today on this episode. Karen is, of course, the Faithless Feminist. She was on the podcast last year when we were talking about her book, Women Beyond Belief, Discovering Life Without Religion, in which she presented the stories of 22 women who had left religion behind and the toxic effects like it had on me and my friends of these religions in their life. Now, we are going to be getting into her new book, which is coming out on the 1st of June this year. It's called Women v. Religion, The Case Against Faith and for Freedom. And of course, if you've been listening in the last couple of weeks, I've had Valerie Wade and Deanna Adams on the show. And of course, they both contributed a chapter to Karen's new book, really tracing the history of African-American women and Christianity in the United States. And that was an absolutely amazing set of conversations that I was able to have with Deanna and Valerie. And hopefully, you have listened to those. If not, I would encourage you to go back and catch those two conversations. But today, as I say, we're going to be getting into a conversation that I had right before I left for Seattle. In fact, we talk about this kind of funny because in the state of Washington, marijuana has been legalized and Karen offered to buy me flowers. And I was thinking, hey, well, instead of buying me flowers, just take me to a pot shop. And funny enough, even though I saw some, I never had the chance to get into one. So the next time I'm over there, I'll do some field research. Yeah, that's what we call it. But of course, if you've been to Amsterdam, you know it's legal there, so it's really not that big a deal. Now, before I bring you the chat with Karen in just a few minutes, I want to take care of a little bit of business. One of the things that I've been working on, as you may know if you've been subscribing to the show for a while, is that I started last year the Post-Evangelical Writers Group on Facebook. And if you're interested in more of that, if you consider yourself a post-evangelical or ex-evangelical, someone who's left the church behind and maybe is interested in processing that, we are working on a collaborative book project. I am super excited about this because the end of April basically are when drafts are due from the various contributors to this book. And we're working with an editor that I met up with while we were in Seattle. We had a great ex-evangelical meetup at a Starbucks just south of Seattle last week. And hopefully I'm going back to Seattle in about a month. And we're going to try to get another group together. So if you're in the Seattle area or the Pacific Northwest area, you can meet up with us at some point while I'm there. I would love to meet you in person. But anyway, on this subject of the book, I'm super excited about it because it's all of us processing our own various experiences of Christianity, specifically related to how one specific doctrine has impacted our lives emotionally, physically, or whatever. I'm writing on how I was baptized 3 times and how that affected me emotionally, spiritually, and so forth throughout my life. And other people are writing from various points of view. So it's going to be a great book. So I'm really excited about that. That's a good development. So if you want to be a part of the Post-Evangelical Writers Group, look us up on Facebook or send me a message and I'll send you the link to the group. If you look in the show notes, I will provide details of how you can contact me in terms of social media, email, and so forth. Maybe the easiest way is to find me on Twitter at MindShift2018. and then just connect with me that way and we can go from there. I'll just mention too that there's ways you can help support the show, help me to cover my expenses every month. You can go to patreon.com/mindshiftpodcast. If you're a subscriber on Podbean, you'll also see the Become a Patron button on the Podbean site. So you can do that as well. Help me to kind of meet my expenses and bringing you this show each and every Friday. Now, returning to the subject of Karen's new book, I wanted to share something with you from her introduction chapter. Now, she's not just bashing Christianity, even though she calls herself the faithless feminist. She's looking at Abrahamic religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, and specifically looking at how those religions have treated women, not just historically, but presently. And there's a whole variety of women that have contributed chapters to her book. And it's quite interesting because she says in her introduction chapter, Karen says, quote, "Today, religion has permeated every aspect of our beliefs about who we are, where we come from, or where we go after we die. It has influenced our music, our language, our rituals, our communities, our political systems, and everything else that can be called culture since that time." And she goes on to say, "Its legacy, unfortunately, that is religion, has not had a benign effect on women. All of the Abrahamic religions originally subjugated women, making them less worthy than men, unable to participate in religious leadership, and even responsible for original sin. Women were considered property and could be bought and sold like slaves and killed for committing adultery or for not being virgins when they married. They couldn't own property and were considered unclean." She concludes, she says, "Women have made progress in terms of equal rights with men, at least in Western democracies, but even these gains have been fairly recent," end quote. And so specifically in the book, she and her contributors focus on the impact of these religions on women. And she says a little bit later in the introduction chapter, she says, quote, "When examining the causes of the unequal status of women anywhere in the world, it would be hard to find a bigger culprit than religion, particularly monotheism and the Abrahamic traditions that form the basis for Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Together, these three religions are embraced by 55% of the global population," end quote. So a little bit more than half the world's population claim to follow one of these three religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And as the book discusses, historically, these religions have had a long history of subjugating women, and even now to this day. In fact, the other day, my wife was telling me she went to church in the States, and one of the things that the preacher was talking about was how God, Jesus, and the Holy Spirit were all male. They were all to be referred to as he, and he even said Satan's a he, too. So why he felt the need to throw Satan in there, it just shows you how threatened that some of these evangelicals are by this idea that God might be referred to as a she. So he went way out of his way to bang on about how God, Jesus, and the Spirit, and even Satan, were all he. You know, so this patriarchal system is still being reinforced even today in many churches, certainly in North America, that we still see. And I, for one, I'm super happy to have met Karen, and then through her, to have met such wonderful women like Valerie and Deanna, and to be able to bring you those conversations. So I'm glad that this is Karen's passion, and I'm excited to see what comes out of this whole discussion. So let's go on into the chat with Karen as we discuss women the religion. All right, I am here once again with Karen Garst, the faithless feminist. Thank you, Karen, for being back on Mindshift Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me on twice.
You're the first one that's been a repeat guest, so that's an amazing
thing. I'm so
honored. Yes. Yeah, it was great.
What kind of flowers would you like?
Well, let's see. You live in Oregon, right?
I live in beautiful Oregon.
Beautiful Oregon. Well, I was going to say, in Washington State, they can grow marijuana, but you can't do that quite yet in Oregon, which is surprising.
Yes, you can.
Oh, you can in
Oregon. Yes, you can.
Well.
Oh, man. Hey, I live in a little town of 10,000 people, and we have two marijuana shops.
Yeah, I'm sure. There's a bit of growing your own going on there. Well, I'm coming to Seattle in a couple of weeks, so we'll have a look at some of these pot shops. This is a new law that's been passed since I was there last, so it's going to be quite interesting, but. I'm so glad that you're on the show again. We're here to talk about your new book. You got a new book coming out in June, is that right?
That's correct.
It's called
Women, the Religion, the Case Against Faith and for Freedom.
Now, you were on the podcast last year, And back then we talked about your first book, which is called Women Beyond Belief, Discovering Life Without Religion. What is the differences between these two books and how did you get involved? Maybe we should kind of go back and talk about your backstory a little bit. How did you become the faithless feminist?
Well, I retired. I was executive director of the Oregon State Bar, and I retired and spent about 5 years doing my genealogy, which was fascinating. I think we may have talked about this before. I'm related to the Wheelock in England.
Oh, yes.
And went to Chester, real close there, and went to Merthyr Tydfil in Wales to see one of my other ancestors' locations. So it was great. And yeah. Then in 2014, on June 30th, the United States Supreme Court issued its decision in Burwell v. Hobby Lobby. Now, Burwell is Attorney General, and Hobby Lobby's craft store in the United States. And in a 5-4 decision, they said that this Hobby Lobby craft store did not have to provide certain forms of birth control to its female employees under the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. And I became incensed. I thought, hey, I was, you know, came of age in the 60s and 70s, and we're fighting about this. We're fighting about reproductive rights again. And I became very concerned because the rationale they used for their decision was that Hobby Lobby had certain religious beliefs. And it was their religious beliefs that did not allow them to provide these forms of birth control, which were mostly abortifacients. So I decided that I needed to do something about it, and I decided to write a book. I contacted a marketing person, and he said, well, you have to have a blog. I have to have a blog, too. And the first name he suggested for the blog was Godless Grandmother, and I said, yeah, let's not emphasize my age. So we came up with Faithless Feminist.
So you've been the Faithless Feminist ever since.
I've been the Faithless Feminist. And the first book, Women Beyond Belief, Discovering Life Without Religion, 22 essays of women. There, no Islamic faith is included in that book, but people from who were born in Africa, Peru, the United States, Germany, all told their stories of why they left religion. And then I had an opportunity to attend the Women in Secularism conference, and I met a lot of women who were active. And so I decided to do another book. And this one is a series of 13 essays by women who are mostly atheist activists who have already written books. And each of them explores a different topic of how women are subjugated to religion.
So what is it about this? There's two kind of aspects to this, isn't there? On the one hand, there's the effects of religion, full stop, because your new book, you don't just cover Christianity, you cover Islam and Judaism too, isn't that right?
That's correct.
So you could say Abrahamic religions.
And the Abrahamic religions, plus there, almost every aspect you can look at of the influence of religion. For example, I know we talked earlier about Candace Gorham. She's a mental health counselor, so she talks about the impact of religion on our psyche. You can get PTSD from somebody thanking you every time you do something and talking about you're going to go to hell. That stays with people, particularly people. I have a friend who was raised in a cult, and she has PTSD to this day. Then Alexis Record talks about this very, very conservative education program called Accelerated Christian Education. And Norway in 2001 banned the curriculum for violating their Gender Equality Act. It's that bad because a mother's roles are discussed as helper, cook, clean, etc. And then we have somebody go through the Bible. We've got somebody who's an ex-Muslim. We have two of the women that you've interviewed, Valerie Wade and Deanna Adams, talk about the impact on African Americans. And then we have Marilyn DeLasia and Hypatia Alexandria talk about the impact on Latinas. And then finally, Kaylee Whalen talks about transgender issues. Abby Hafer talks about evolution. And we have two women from Canada. One of them is an atheist minister, and the other one is somebody who helps people in the South Asian community in Canada who have been abused.
They're all women who have these various perspectives on these Abrahamic religions. I was going to say that's kind of the second piece of it. On the one hand, you've got the toxic effects of religion more generally, perhaps, but then specifically on women. What is it about the effects of religion, these three religions really, on women specifically that's different than let's say my experience. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a fundamentalist church, and reading through Candace's chapter, I'm going, I probably have PTSD. I've got hell-induced PTSD and everything else from watching movies like A Thief in the Night and things like that. But looking at how it's affected women, mm-hmm. and how women are treated, what's the angle there? Why is it a special thing to focus on with this book?
Well, let's go back a little. Let's go back about 15,000 years. Does that work for you?
Okay, sure. Jump in the time machine. We'll go back.
Well, if we look at the Paleolithic era, and most people were hunter-gatherers at that time, and they didn't, you know, necessarily know how the baby was formed, but they knew that this woman has her period, and she bleeds, and she doesn't die. Now, you're a man, you go out hunting, you get hurt, you bleed out there, you're dead.
You're going to die out there.
And then they determined, and then they find out that she has it 13 times a year, which is exactly the number of moon cycles. Now, sure, it took probably a millennium for them to figure that out, but can you imagine what they thought? Like, wow, she bleeds, she doesn't die, she has these cycles like the moon, and there was a veneration for Mother Earth. They needed Mother Earth. They needed that spring to come back every year. They needed the plants to grow every year. So they were very tuned to Earth's cycles. And there are many people who posit that it probably was either a mother goddess reverence with a shaman who could have been a woman, could have been a man, but there was something about the Earth and those cycles that was central to their belief. Then you jump forward to about 8,000 years ago, and we have herding and agriculture. And it was pretty much downhill after that. Because what happened was, number one, men discovered that the sperm had something to do with it. And it wasn't until 1827 when doctors figured out about the egg in the ovary. So all this time they think, well, I'm the one who makes the child, really. And they started to accumulate property. And once you accumulate property or goods or anything, you want to give it to your progeny. Well, the only way you can know if your progeny, if you're a man, is that the woman is a virgin when she's married and she can't commit adultery. So those two pivotal things started to get woven into their society, woven into their culture. And they already had this kind of supernatural tendency, because we all do. It's like we want to find agency. We want to know why does this happen. We want to explain things. And so what happened by the time you get to, I don't even want to say organized religion, but let's, you know, jump ahead, okay? Jump ahead to about 2000 BCE. You have gods and goddesses. So they haven't eliminated the goddess. She's still there. But then at about that time, you have civilizations like the Babylonians who had male and female gods and goddesses, and their story enumerated in Enuma Elish, like that little play upon words there, enumerated,
yes.
Enuma Elish.
I see what you did.
And Marduk is the head male. And he says to the other male gods, if you make me chief god, I'll kill Tiamat, who is the female goddess. So they do that, and then they have a total, not exactly monotheistic, but they have a male-dominated deity. And we have to understand that the Israelites, once the Babylonians destroyed Jerusalem and took them prisoner in 586 BCE, they were influenced by that. And they probably said, God, we need a male god because we got, you know, our butts kicked by these Babylonians. And so then you get the start of monotheism. But through all this time, the property has been going through the male. So you've, you know, over thousands of years, you get an elite. And you get now, in the Jewish religion, you get Levites, who are these elite priests. And they have for, you know, millennia put down women. And so it's first encoded. The Abrahamic religions are first encoded in the first five books of the Bible. And it's very clear that they took the symbols of this goddess. A snake is often associated with goddesses because of its regenerative power. And in Canaan, there was a goddess called Asherah. She was worshipped in the tree, you know, in the forest, in the trees, or with a pole. And so you take in that first image of Genesis, you take the garden, you take a tree, you take a snake, you make a woman, and you turn them all upside down. And now woman is the cause of sin.
That's obviously a huge theme. I think we may have touched on this in the last podcast, that that tradition going back to Genesis 1 and 2 and 3 has resonated through Judaism and Christianity. Certainly Christianity, hasn't it? You see it in Paul, where he says, you know, Adam wasn't deceived, but Eve certainly was, and she led him astray. And where that's been taken by Christianity to subjugate women and to blame them for the fall and sin introduced into the human race. So you're starting out with one big major strike against you right there off the bat.
Exactly. And I talk a little bit about that in the introduction to the book, but Valerie Chirico, who is the author of Thrusting Down and a blogger, writes a chapter called Owned. And she traces all the way through the Old and New Testament, all of these images, these sayings about women being property, women being dirty, women being unclean, women being killed if they commit adultery. And goes to the New Testament where you must be submissive, you're a helpmeet, be quiet in church, etc. So from the very beginning, these two Abrahamic faiths have put down women. And then when Christianity becomes the norm of the Holy Roman Empire, you have all of the church people like Tertullian and those kind of people reinforcing it, and they become even worse.
So they reinforce it all the way,
even through Protestant Reformation, you have Martin Luther saying, if a woman dies when she has a child, it doesn't matter. The child is born, and that's all she's good for.
And
we could talk about Islam, but it does exactly the same thing. So you have a holy book that's sitting in the pews of those churches that says women are dirty and unclean and are worth nothing and committed sin, and they're the reason for the fall.
It's reflected in things like the purity culture. You mentioned that too. You said that a woman has to be a virgin when she gets married, and that's still going on in evangelical churches today. This purity culture nonsense, abstinence teaching. People are making a good living going all over America, teaching high schools, public secular high schools, kids about abstinence from a religious Christian point of view. So this is very much part and parcel of what's going on certainly in America today, in the public sector. They're getting huge grants from the government to go teach on abstinence in public high schools.
Exactly. And we talked a little before the show, but certainly my concerns and fears in 2014 about that Supreme Court decision have expanded exponentially with the appointment of Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, and the real possibility that there may yet be another appointee by Trump, to say nothing about the education secretary he's appointed and, charter schools, to say nothing about the attacks on Planned Parenthood, to say nothing about the attacks on reproductive rights and safe and affordable abortion. Right. So actually, it's a lot worse than it was in 2014.
And transgender as well. Because we just had on this podcast a couple of weeks ago, a friend of mine, Dana Stinson, who came out as a transgender woman. And in the introduction, I talked about we're going backwards in terms of the flow of society. But Trump is legislating you can't have transgender people serving in the military. All these things are ways to appeal to his conservative evangelical base, it seems like. Yeah, so we're going against the flow, basically.
Yeah, and Kaylee Whalen, who is the digital strategies and social media manager at the National LGBTQ Task Force, writes an essay about she was raised in the Catholic Church, and they kept information from her. You know, and transgender people are not mistakes that need to be corrected. And they're you know, a lot of other cultures, ones that are no longer here, ones that may still be here, have more than two genders. There's a spectrum, if you will, of gender. And what's interesting in Abby Hafer's essay, and she wrote The Not-So-Intelligent Designer, she talks about evolution, and there is a cell that has seven different sexes. It's a eukaryotic, I'm not sure I'm going to be saying that one right, but basically each of those entities, for can't find a better word, can mate with those other six, and that's 85% of the population. So we have a huge history in biology of different sexes, and we know from some Native American cultures there was more than one sex allowed or respected, whatever. So so we need to kind of get in with it. This is the way it is. And some re-education or deconversion or conversion process isn't going to help.
There's a lot of Christian quote-unquote counselors out there who will gay conversion therapy and trans, you know, gender identity conversion therapy. They'll straighten you out according to their views of the Bible. So yeah, there's a whole industry, a whole cottage industry of this conversion therapy and abstinence training. And they're trying to enforce their particular worldview, their theological perspective on society.
Yeah, and a couple of the women who write about it, mentioned their names earlier about Latinas. They're kind of, you know, number one, certainly with a Trump administration, that is not a group of people that he is very respectful of, but they were raised in the Catholic Church and their culture is get married early and have kids. Well, that doesn't allow the woman any time to develop or explore her personal goals at all. So she is thrust into that, have a lot of kids, and kids are a lot of work. And so there she is. I mean, I always tell people, I said, don't get married until you're 30. You don't know who you are. You haven't had a chance to explore who you want to be. It's too soon. It's not going to work out. Wait, please wait. And we certainly don't need Quiverfill and the Mormons and everyone having 10 kids. I mean, the planet is populated enough. Thank you very much.
Well, the theology is very bizarre anyway, because parents treat the child almost as a commodity, because if they deliver a virgin to the altar on his or her wedding day, then somehow God will bless them more. They'll bless the marriage more with more kids and with all these amazing blessings, and the blessings will rebound back on the parents for having delivered this virgin to the altar on his or her wedding day. So there's a whole bizarre theology that's wrapped up in this whole thing of abstinence, purity culture. It's not just confined to evangelicalism, is it?
Absolutely. And Aruna Papp wrote an essay. She was born in India and her father was a Christian preacher. And her father's mother, the grandmother, totally put down her mom because she was having girls.
She wasn't having
boys. This woman.
As if it was her choice
so
somehow.
She's so embedded in this culture that she supports her son having to have a son to carry on. She could care less about her son having daughters. Well, she had, Aruna's mom had four girls and then had a boy, and it was praise be, praise be to God. And then the mother kept on having children, had two more children that were girls, crying for another boy. And Aruna, living in India, there was a girl, a teenager, who had dishonored the family, who was put on fire and immolated, dead, next door to her, and the police didn't do anything.
And nothing they would do about it. It's just part of the culture, isn't it? Unfortunately, it's unbelievable that it happens, but it still does, doesn't it?
Yes, it still does. In fact, it even happened in California, where a man, I think he drove over his daughter, who had done something to dishonor the family. Now, at least here, he went to prison.
At least, yeah, he went to jail.
There's so many different influences. And what I wanted to do in this book was kind of, this is, if you can read this book from cover to cover and stay religious, then don't read any other books.
This is the last book you should read.
If you can't see through these women's stories, which are very well researched, it's not academic per se, but it's more than just personal stories. It is, here's what it was like in Africa before we came. There were goddesses. Here's what it was like before Mohammed. And Mohammed's wife was a head of a caravan. She was a businesswoman. And there was a woman in the army in some tribe that fought against Mohammed. And that was all erased.
All erased from the record. Well, now, speaking of Islam, have you gotten any pushback? It's difficult to speak out against Islam in some quarters, isn't it?
Well, my response to that is, I'm not talking about the people. I'm talking about the book. I'm talking about the culture. I'm talking about what they tell people. And I don't care whether it's Islam, Judaism, or Christianity, or any other religion. It's all the same. They're all myths. They were designed specifically to support patriarchy. And they're based on men's stories. They're made up. So So I don't care what book it is. Now, this book, you can pre-order it on Amazon. It doesn't come out till June 1st, but we'll see what I get from that perspective. But I really wanted to include somebody who is an ex-Muslim. She does write under a pen name, you know, a pseudonym, because she personally doesn't want to get a lot of flack. But she's done a real good job of researching the history of Islam and what it was like before. And I remember checking the references, and oh, it's so complicated because, you know, there's the Quran, but then there's the Hadith, there's everything else that comes along with it. So it's complicated.
Very complicated, isn't it? It's not a monolithic thing. And that's one thing about Islam, too, is it's not just a monolithic religion. There's all kinds of branches, Shiite, Sunni, Muslims, there's fundamentalists, but there's more liberal Muslims. So it's a very complex religion. But as you say, your perspective is basically Islam, Judaism, and Christianity being all three Abrahamic religions. They definitely reinforce these patriarchal narratives, don't they, in their sacred texts. And then you see it in practice as well.
Yes, and I watched a debate between an ex-Muslim and that was a gentleman, and then a woman who said, you know, her idea was to reform it. And my issue is whether it's Christianity or Judaism, et cetera. Yeah, there are some that are very, very, very conservative, Orthodox Judaism as an example. But the bottom line is it's all based on a myth. And why can't we instead move forward and say, look, let's do something about humanism. Let's do something about, you know, the earth and saving the earth that we live on. Let's do something to support people who are homeless. Let's do something about that and focus on that. And what's interesting in the United States is there's a number of kind of atheist groups, but there's also things like the Sunday Assembly, where people get together on Sunday, they do music, they hear presentations. It's got that same community there. It's got the same, you know, kind of rituals. It's got music. It's pretty much what everyone likes in church and why they keep going. But it's because it's secular. So
it doesn't have the ideology.
Yeah. And then there's, you know, there's the Unitarian Universalists, which are pretty much the same thing. And so you do have some options to be able to keep that community together. One of the authors of my first book, when she and her husband left the church, nobody in that church would have anything to do with them. And it was all their friends. I mean, they lost every single friend they had because they left the church. Can you imagine?
Yeah, they just ghosted them,
you know,
basically.
You're caught up in this community that's your whole life, and you decide that, no, I don't believe in God anymore, and they don't want anything to do with you.
That was a similar thing with Dana Stinson. She when she came out as a trans woman, They were required to read a letter to the board, and everyone said, oh, that was brave and that was amazing. Let's have lunch. Let's have coffee. I'll call you. Nothing ever came of it. All those people that they were a big part of their lives for years in their church in Pennsylvania, all of them ghosted them. They not one single person contacted her, and they all just fell out of her life. All the while claiming, we're the family of God. We're all part of this community, but yet not anymore. Not
exactly.
Not that you're a trans woman. Not going to happen now.
Or there are some women who write, you know, kind of as apologists and try to pick out the few instances in the Bible where there might be a woman portrayed well. Deborah as a fighter, queen, whatever she was, and other things like that. But you got to look at, you know, the people who are portrayed and held up in Christianity is a woman who's a virgin, who gave birth. Okay, let's see. That'd be tough. I can't do that.
Can't live up to that.
So something is lauded that's not possible.
I was talking to a friend of mine the other day. She's going to be on the podcast at some point coming up here. And she's done a lot of work on that Mary narrative. And that's that whole kind of, it's fed into a rape culture and all kinds of other things. So there's a lot of problems associated with that text as well, from a female point of view too, not just the fact that, yeah, she's held up as this impossible ideal for women. She's the mother of God and everything else. So yeah, there's a lot of problems. I think, you know, one of the things you mentioned before, I wanted to go back. You said that, you know, it's a Christianity, Judaism, and Islam are all myths based on a patriarchal narrative and some other things. I think a lot of people out there are listening and they're in the process of deconstructing whatever faith they may have left. I don't know if there's anything left. Yeah. But how far do you go with it? I mean, where you said you kind of talked about this a little bit. What would you like to see people doing instead of going to church and you know, following these mythologies and so forth?
Well, I think if you go back to look at patriarchy, what was it about? It was about power and control. And I think we see with Trump, who probably didn't go to church at all, that he has embraced these evangelicals for power and control and has got them in as part of his base. So the problem with, you know, these kind of economic structures that are about power and control and have an elite, every institution is going to match up with that, and religion does. And how to deconstruct all of that is going to be very, very difficult. I think we can start by continuing to talk to people that this is a myth, that it's very bad for women. It portrays them as chattel, just like there's one phrase, a donkey and a slave and a woman. You know, they're kind of equated together there.
On the same level.
That it's very harmful. It's very harmful for our children. And the more evangelical you get and fundamentalist, you're damaging those children for life. Because what they learn when they're young is so influential. Later on, we talked a little bit about, you know, PTSD. And I think what's important is that we let go of that. And then we start to look at how can we live together? There's billions of people on this planet. How can we live together and not use the structure we've got to just kill people? You know, it's like it's aggressive, it's violent, it's I'm bigger than you are. I want to, whether Trump says he's more important than Putin or Putin says he's more important than Trump, that whole structure is going to end up killing the planet.
You know, of course, Karen, that if you tell Christians that, or Jews or Muslims that, their religion is a myth, you're going to get some serious pushback. I remember a few years ago, there was a BBC documentary. I think it was a three-part series called The Bible's Buried Secrets. I don't know if you came across it, but it was by a woman. She's a lecturer in Hebrew Bible down at the University of Exeter over here in the United Kingdom. And I'll probably butcher her name, but it's a tough Greek name to pronounce. Her name's Francesca Stavrakopoulou. She teaches Bible and theology, but she's an atheist, and she came out and she talked in this one program was about whether or not the real person, King David, whether or not he existed from an archaeological and historical point of view. Now, she concluded that there was no such person as David, that he was a mythological character. And you should have seen the firestorm over here in the United Kingdom that one episode caused. I remember a few days after it aired, I got an email that had made the rounds as part of the Society of Biblical Literature by one of their leading people, this Old Testament expert, and he ripped her to shreds and sent out this mass email to all the SBL people saying that she was basically a heretic and how dare she question the historicity of King David and on and on and on. Now, that's just one person. That's just King David. Now, you're talking about the whole Bible. you want to, you know, get yourself into some hot water here. You're going to go ahead and publish this book and see what happens.
Well, there's an interesting chapter written by Greta Vosper, and she is a minister in Canada to the church that's prevalent in Canada. And she, at one point in time, said, I don't believe this anymore.
Yeah,
she's
come out as an atheist.
And she decided to come out to her congregation as an atheist.
Yeah, that's an amazing story.
She thought long and hard about it, and is this the right thing to do? And that denomination, by the way, is the United Church of Canada. And some people left her congregation.
As
some
they would.
Stayed, and she attracted more. So you said, what can we do in place of? We can still use those communities. We can still use those facilities and talk about humanism and talk about how we can help each other. And talk about some fundamental morality, which is not treating women as a dirty piece of meat.
Well, and something
we could use those same things.
Yeah, something that Hector Avalos said. Why do we need an ancient book to tell us what to do now in terms of ethics and morality from a purely humanist point of view. Why can't we just take care of each other and take care of the planet, the environment? Why do we have to drag God into it, the Bible, the Quran, whatever text, the Talmud, whatever you want to put in there? It doesn't have to be exclusive to Christianity, does it?
No, not at all.
And I think that's a major challenge, isn't it? Because for a lot of people that I'm in connection with that are deconstructing their Christian faith, like me, coming out of fundamentalism, coming out of evangelicalism, you're going, well, what happens next? Where do we go from here?
Yeah.
Because this was a huge part of my life. This was a huge part of all of our lives. If you were raised in the church, I mean, I spent years and years in school, in academics, and in ministry, and as a teacher. And most of my adult life has been involved in some way, shape, or form with the church. And now I'm looking at it and questioning all this. And I'm thinking, I read that introduction chapter, and I thought, yeah, I've got PTSD too from this toxic theology that I was raised with. You know, what's your advice to someone who's sitting there at the end of his or her rope and doesn't know what to do next? You know, you mentioned Sunday, what was it, Sunday assemblies? There's things you can do. There's other things you can do, isn't there?
Yeah, and I would say be careful. You've got to assess your situation before you do come out. I mean, if you're a 14-year-old and you're in an evangelical family, you've got to be careful because you just don't know what kind of pushback you're going to get. While you were talking about your upbringing, it's interesting to me. I was raised as a Lutheran in North Dakota. Everybody I knew went to church, or there were five Jewish families. Rabbi came from Fargo. You know, I was in Bismarck. But when I went to college, I went to a Lutheran college, Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota, and our first class, Religion 101, talked about the different oral strains of the Old Testament. Now, I don't know what can be more heretical than saying, this isn't the inspired word of God. This person wrote, and then this person corrected it, and there's two creation stories, and there's two stories of this, and then there's two lineages of that. And it was fascinating to me, because, of course, I'd never heard that in Sunday school or anything, but they were very open. The second year my religion class was on culture and society, and I found at Concordia in the library a book called Gay World. And I didn't know anything about gays. And I read it and said, well, there's nothing wrong with that. And I gave a report to my class. And it was totally, well, that's interesting. And this was at a religious college. But that doesn't compare at all to, you know, the way you were raised or the Catholic Church or, you know, the Old Testament where you had to marry a rapist. And, you know, there's different degrees. So for me,
yes,
it was much easier to leave.
You were, I guess, yeah, it was more liberal, I guess, in that way, theologically, wasn't it? Because the Bible college and seminary that I went to, you know, we talked about higher criticism and things like that, but they were the enemy. You know, Moses wrote the Pentateuch and the Bible's inspired, and we had to defend that on all possible levels. And, you know, homosexuality was evil and wrong, and the Bible condemned it and everything else. And that was the worldview.
Yeah. I had my junior year, I had a course in Catholicism because I thought that would be interesting. And, the teacher wrote his name on the board, Father Emmerich Lawrence, comma, O period S period B period. And he says, now don't get the order of those letters confused. And he had us keep a journal. We had to read a Catholic newspaper and comment on it. And then at the end of the semester, he commented on what we wrote. I still have it. I mean, it was fascinating. And I learned a lot, and he was totally open about, you know, here's the difference between Catholicism and Protestantism and yada yada. But we just learned so much about people and different people, and it was really a fascinating course. So totally different upbringing than you, but I still think we need to get rid of it all. Because, there's too many negative things about it, and it's used too much as an excuse to put other people down. And the reason I got involved originally was women's rights, and I am very concerned about our country overturning Roe v. Wade. There will always be abortions. The question is whether they're going to be back alley or not. And we would go back, you know, 50 years in our progress if that were to happen. And I just think that, you know, Trump, by attracting himself to all these evangelicals, is going to, you know, to get reelected, he's going to do their bid. And I'm very concerned about it.
Well, there's a theology, though, operative as well, isn't there? And this is, I've talked about this in other podcasts, this covenant theology. And that's a big part of it. That's one of the big drivers behind, I think, a lot of what evangelicals are trying to do and why they've allied themselves with Trump, because they're, in their point of view, they're saying, we need to get rid of abortion. We need to outlaw homosexuality. Mm-hmm. We need to ban transgender troops. We need to do all these things because that's what God wants us to do. And when we do that, he will start blessing America again. And in their view, make America great again. And somehow God's part of that. And so if Trump delivers on those agendas, they can overlook all the moral failings, as we said before, because he's delivering on his promises. And therefore, somehow God will bless him. In fact, one of the latest things that's going around is to equate Donald Trump with King David, you know, and say, well, King David had a lot of flaws and he did some horrible things, but God used him in a mighty way. And so can God can use Trump. So he can get his work done through a very flawed person. So they'll use the Bible to justify literally anything.
Yeah, I've seen some interviews of Trump supporters who are evangelical, and you're right. I hadn't heard the thing about David, but, you know, they totally dismiss. It's kind of like, well, boys will be boys. Yeah, he did that. But boy, he's leading the country in the right direction, and this is what's important, and that stuff happened a long time ago. We don't care. We need to look forward, and, you know, he's going to restore America. And look at all the racial implications of some of that as well, and what's happening not only in immigration, but, you know, in the United States. I mean, it's a total way to just divide people. And, you know, you asked earlier, well, we need to come together. We're all on this planet, and I don't care whether you're living in the Philippines or South America or Africa. We need to recognize humanity in each of us and just say, let's look at what brings us together and we have in common rather than focusing on the differences. But all of these economies are built on this, get to the top of the mountain and be the biggest and be the best. And it doesn't foster that kind of thinking. It fosters look at Kim Jong-un. He got this little country. He could have developed that country. He could have fed his people. He could have made it so people in South Korea wanted to go to the North. But he didn't. He and his father got on this. We got to get the United States. We're going to get the United States. We're going to beat him, and we're going to develop nuclear weapons. And he's starving his population because of it. I mean, I think that's a real extreme of how far you go to get power and control. And that's what our system's based on. And I think we're finding now, I mentioned to you that I'm debating a woman who's a men's rights activist saying that women have achieved gender equality, and now we got problems with men. Well, one of the issues of gender is we've developed these stereotypes for men and women, and the ones for men are, you know, aggressive, rational, pushes forward, and women are nurturing, kind, gentle. And then you go and try to get, you're a man and try to get custody of your kids. Guess what? Those stereotypes play against you.
So it ends up biting you in the ass in the end anyway.
Exactly. And I think people are realizing it. You know, I don't care whether you're a man or a woman, you kind of got to look at the system. You know, and here's what the system favors, and it's kind of a little bit about like that 19th century story of Horatio Alger. Oh, you just keep trying hard, you'll get there. That isn't the way it works. It's like there's a mountain, and the elite's at the top, and you're kind of struggling on the side, and then there's an elevator in the middle, accumulated wealth. You know, how many people are the elite? Are descendants of Sam Walton, who created Walmart. They're up there, not because of anything they did. They're up there because of something, you know, a previous ancestor did. So that wealth accumulates, and you've got this elite at the top. You're not going to get there. You know, it's an illusion. And why do we have to have a system that's based on the 1% getting everything? Why should it be that way? Is there an alternative?
Well, I think that's a good question, really, for the whole discussion, isn't it? Because we've said this before, that it's true. Our American society is incredibly deeply divided along political lines, religious lines, ideological lines, racial lines. And how can we bring that together? If we're just going to pass a bunch of laws, that's not necessarily going to make people sit down at the table and have some sort of respectful dialogue, is it? But, you know, one thing I appreciate about your book is that you are doing that. You're bringing women together from different religions, different ethnic backgrounds, and saying, okay, let's hear their stories. Mm-hmm. Let's hear. And you did this with your other book too. I know, bringing all these women from different parts of the world to say, we need to listen to these women's stories. We need to take these perspectives on board. And this is part of getting this discussion going, because passing laws isn't necessarily going to get it done, is it?
Right. And I think it's really important, because if you go to Amazon, for example, and Google best 100 books on atheism, 95% of those are written by men. And it's not that they're not good books. I mean, The God Delusion is a fantastic book. A lot of the things that Four Horsemen wrote are very good, but they don't specifically explore the impact of religion on women. And I think that is where there's a huge hole, and why I've written these two books, why I continue to have a blog. And I want to encourage more women to get involved and to do a podcast, do a blog, but talk about the impact on women, because if women leave the churches will be empty.
Yeah, the average is about 70% of most church population is women. They're the ones giving the money. This is something that Deanna and I talked about, especially in the African-American church. The women are the ones really doing everything. They're the ones funding the place. They're the ones running the place. Yet somehow the 5% of men are the ones at the top. They're the pastoral staff. They're the ones making all the decisions. And these women, and a lot of them are single women, actually, that are kind of kept in this state of singlehood. And she's quite passionate about it. It's just an unbelievable kind of state of affairs. And she's trying to shed light on it.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking about in the United States, primarily Christianity. Look at what they do in Muslim countries. I mean, there are still countries, places in Africa, they do genital mutilation.
That's true.
They carve out the clitoris of women so that they can't ever feel pleasure. I don't know of anything more barbaric than that.
And somehow that's tied to their religious beliefs.
Yes. And we have it. And I would say you take Iceland and Norway and Sweden, they're the least religious countries. Iceland is the highest on pay equity and the least religious. Duh. I mean, let's make a connection here.
Something's got to be done.
It would be better for women not to have religion play such a role in our government. And it's men. You look at a conference table where Trump is talking about reproductive rights and the only people you see are white men. I, as a woman, get a little concerned about that.
Not a single woman in the photograph or literally in the picture.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I want to be at the table. You know, and I think a lot of women are stepping up to run for office that I have ever seen before. Now, I live in Oregon. We have our second woman governor. We have probably one of the highest majorities of women in our legislature. But we've really worked hard at that. I mean, I joined a group 30 years ago called WinPAC, which was Women's Investment Network, where we supported pro-choice Democratic women. And, you know, it's kind of like 30 years. It takes a lot of work.
It does take a lot of work. And I think it's going to be interesting seeing the midterm elections coming up this year. There's all these predictions as to what's going to happen, but there could very well be a massive backlash. And it's part of what's been going on for the last couple of years on the conservative side. So yeah, there's going to be some really interesting developments. Well, I don't want to keep you too long, Karen. I know we have had a great conversation. I was just going to say, how do people get a hold of your book? It's coming out in June. Is that right?
Right. And it's Women, V, Religion, The Case Against Faith and for Freedom. And it's available for pre-order online, Amazon. I'm pretty sure it's on Barnes & Noble, and it will be in bookstores. So you can order it now, and you'll be getting the first copy.
And there's also a little bit of an overview on your blog. What's the what's your address of your blog, if you want to find out a little bit more about the book?
Yeah, it's www.faithlessfeminist.com. And I think it was 2 weeks ago that I put up one about the book, which is outlines each of the essays, and you can find that on my blog site.
Yeah, so go to faithlessfeminist.com. There's a little bit of an overview of Karen's new book that's coming out in June. So listen, thank you so much, Karen Garst, the Faithless Feminist, for being a repeat guest on the show.
Well, thank you, Clint. It was a great time.
Well, I certainly hope you enjoyed my chat with Karen Garst, the faithless feminist, as we discussed her new book, Women v. Religion, The Case Against Faith and for Freedom. One of the things I appreciate about the book, as I've been reading my way through it, is that it provides a really kind of multi-perspective or multi-point of view experiences of women, specifically with these Abrahamic religions. The very first chapter in the book is written by Candace Gorham, and it's titled Guilt, Shame, and Psychological Pain. And Candace, who is a therapist, she works with a lot of people who come out of religion, and she describes how some of the specific teachings within religion can really trigger people. In her chapter, she says, quote, "Quite often, we find that those who come from highly conservative religious traditions are likely to experience more guilt and shame than liberal believers and non-believers." Now, why is this the case? Well, she goes on to say, in Christianity, this is because the Bible lists literally hundreds of actions or events that would be deemed illegal, immoral, or detrimental to one's relationship with God. The Bible sometimes goes into great detail about these laws and mores, so that when believers commit a violation, and they most certainly will violate something, they are aware of the crime and guaranteed to feel guilty. And she goes on to say, it's something really interesting. She says, while a Christian who breaks a law, also known as committing a sin, might publicly wear guilt like a scarlet letter like they used to do way back in the old days, she says, when the violation is damaging to one's relationship with God, the person is much more likely to struggle with shame. Since shame is such a deeply felt embarrassment, it's quite common for believers to be more ashamed of secret sins than for ones of which everyone is aware. And she concludes, she says, when God is disappointed with us, we are ashamed of ourselves. Since religion is often deeply tied to one's personal and cultural identities, she says, the psychological impact of its precepts can run deeper than those of any other influence, including family, end quote. And I think Candace is absolutely correct when she says this, and she has to treat a huge variety of people who come out of these controlling religions. What is the purpose of religion? Is it to provide a moral and ethical code? And then when you keep those precepts, you feel good about yourself. And when you break those laws, you sin, as it were. You feel bad and you feel ashamed that God is disappointed with you. And this is something that Candace has to deal with in her clients. She talks about clients suffering depression and anxiety, mental illnesses, and all kinds of other issues that they have. She talks about PTSD, and she has all these things that she has to deal with in her clients. And I can definitely identify with what Candace is talking about. This is something my friends and I in Seattle recently, we touched base on, the toxic effects of Christianity, specifically in our lives, looking back on our past and how we've had to have counseling and therapy to deal with these things. And maybe that describes you as well. So if that's the case, I think you will benefit from picking up a copy of Karen's book. You can go to Amazon. And even though, as I say, the book isn't out until the 1st of June, you can pre-order a copy. So as soon as it comes out, you'll have your edition of Women v. Religion, The Case Against Faith and for Freedom. And I think you will really get a lot out of Karen's new book. So I highly recommend it. Now, before I let you go, I'm just going to mention real quickly what's coming up in the next few weeks. Well, I've got some fantastic interviews lined up with some more absolutely amazing women. I'm going to be talking to Sarah Smith of the Theosophia podcast. I'm also going to be talking to Stacey Ray, the Resting Traveler, about her new book that's just literally come out in the last week or two. And she's also a member of our post-evangelical writers group. She's going to be contributing a chapter to our book, Into the Wilderness, Life After Evangelicalism. So look for those interviews coming up in the next few weeks. Also, we have to get into some more Brits. So I'm going to be bringing Gary Hayes back onto the show. We're going to be doing some podcasts, hopefully feature one a month. I am really looking forward to working a bit more closely with Gary. In fact, if you have a topic that you want us to discuss specifically, please let me know. In fact, we've already had one request from a listener who wants us to unpack the differences between the British and the American church experience. So we're going to be doing that coming up hopefully within a month or two. So whenever Gary gets back from his teaching gig in Derbyshire, we're going to hook that back up. So thanks again for listening in to the chat between me and Karen Garst, the faithless feminist. I will catch you right here next week on Mindshift Podcast.